Well, she said, if you're not going to eat, you might as well join the others out at the fire. Jess McHale might sing tonight if they can get her to drink enough. And drunk or sober, that woman has the finest voice I've ever heard. I briefly met Dimitri in Sydney's eyes. I admit, I was a little curious to see how this wilderness group partied it up, even though moonshine and folk songs weren't really my first choice of entertainment. Dimitri still wore that haunted look from the phone call. I had a suspicion he would have been content to isolate himself in our room, but when Sydney said she'd go to the fire, his response came automatically.
I'll go too.
I knew instantly what he was doing. His Strigoi days tormented him. Talking to Strigoi tormented him. And maybe? No, certainly. He wanted to hide away and try to block it all out. But he was Dimitri. Dimitri protected those who needed it. And even if listening to fireside songs wasn't exactly life-threatening, it was still a semi-dangerous situation for a civilian like Sydney. He couldn't allow that. Plus, he knew Sydney would feel safer with both of us nearby. I started to say I'd join them, but Joshua spoke before I could.
Do you still want to see my cave? There's a little light left outside. You'll get a better view that way than if we have to use a torch.
I'd forgotten about my last conversation with Joshua and started to decline his offer. But then, something flashed in Dimitri's eyes, something disapproving. So, he didn't want me going off with some young, good-looking guy. Was it legitimate concern about the keepers? Was it jealousy? No, surely not the latter. We'd established, many, many times, that Dimitri wanted no romantic connection with me. He'd even stood up for Adrian earlier. Was this some kind of ex-boyfriend thing? Back in Rubiesville, I'd believed Dimitri and I could be friends. But that wouldn't happen if he thought he could control me and my love life. I'd known girls with exes like that. I wouldn't be one. I could hang out with whomever I wanted. Sure, I said. Dimitri's expression darkened. I'd love to. Joshua and I headed off, leaving the others behind. I knew part of my decision was to prove my independence. Dimitri had said we were equals. Yet he'd made an awful lot of decisions in this escape plan without me. It was nice to feel like I had the upper hand for a change. And besides, I liked Joshua, and was kind of curious to learn more about how his people lived. I don't think Sydney wanted me to leave, but Dimitri would look after her. As Joshua and I walked, we passed plenty of keepers out and about. Just like earlier, I received a fair amount of stares. Rather than lead us down the road to where his father lived, Joshua took me around the small mountain. It was still good-sized, but after living near the Rockies, everything in the Appalachians seemed small to me. I guess I was a mountain snob. Still, the mountain extended quite a ways, and we moved farther and farther from the keeper's main settlement. The forest grew thicker, the light growing scarce as the sun finally began sinking into the horizon.
I'm kind of on the outskirts, Joshua said apologetically. We keep growing and growing, and there's not much room in the town center.
I thought town was an optimistic term, but didn't say so.
Yeah, I was definitely a snob. But the caves keep going, so there's still space.
Are they natural? I asked.
Some are. Some are abandoned mining caves.
It's pretty out here, I said. I liked all the deciduous trees. I might be homesick for Montana, but the wide leaves here were a neat contrast to pine needles. And hey, at least you get lots of privacy, right?
True, he smiled. I figured you'd think it was, I don't know, too rustic or savage. You probably think we all are.
His observation startled me. Most of the keepers had been so fiercely defensive of their way of life that I hadn't thought anyone would even think an outsider would question it, or that any keeper would care if we did. It's just different, I said diplomatically. A lot different from what I'm used to. I felt a flash of homesickness for all the people and places I was now cut off from. Lissa, Adrian, our other friends, Court, St. Vladimir's. I shook the feeling off quickly. I had no time to mope and could at least check on Lissa later.
I've been to human towns, continued Joshua, and other places the tainted live. I can see why you'd like them.
He turned a bit sheepish.
I wouldn't mind electricity.
Why don't you guys use it?
We would if we could. We're just too far out. And no one really knows we're here anyway. The Lily people say it's better for hiding us.
It hadn't occurred to me that they simply endured these conditions because they were forced to in order to conceal themselves. I wondered how many of their choices came from clinging to the so-called old ways, and how much was influenced by the alchemists.
Here we are,
said Joshua, pulling me from my musings. He gestured to a dark hole at ground level. The opening was big enough for an adult to enter.
Nice, I said.
I'd noticed earlier that some of the caves were set higher into the mountains, and had watched their residents either climb the rock bare-handed or use homemade ladders.
An easy-access doorway seemed luxurious.
Joshua looked surprised at my praise.
Really?
Really. We'd ended up losing too much daylight. He paused to light a torch, and then I followed him inside. We had to duck a little at first. But as we went deeper into the cave, the ceiling slowly expanded and opened up into a wide, rounded space. The floor was hard-packed dirt, the stone walls rough and jagged. This was a natural cave, but I could pick out the efforts made to civilize it. The floor had been cleaned and leveled, and I saw some stones and rocks in a corner that looked like they'd been gathered up to clear space. A couple pieces of furniture had already been moved in. A narrow wooden chair and a mattress that looked like it could barely hold one person.
You probably think it's small, said Joshua.
It was true, but it was actually bigger than my dorm room at St. Vladimir's.
Well, yeah, but I mean, how old are you?
18.
Same as me,
I said. This seemed to make him pretty happy.
Having your own, cave at 18 is pretty cool.
It would have been cooler still with electricity, internet, and plumbing, but there was no need to bring that up. His blue eyes practically shone. I couldn't help but notice what a pretty contrast they made against his tanned skin. I dismissed the thought immediately. I wasn't here for a boyfriend, but apparently I was the only one who believed that. Joshua suddenly took a step forward.
You can stay if you want, he said. The other tainted would never find you here. We could get married, and then when we had kids, we could build a loft like my parents and...
The word married had me moving toward the entrance as shocked and panicked as I would be by a Strigoi attack. Except, I usually had fair warning before those.
Whoa, whoa, slow down.
No, I hadn't seen a proposal coming.
We just met!
Thankfully, he didn't come closer.
I know, but sometimes that's how it is.
What, marriages between people who hardly know each other? I asked incredulously.
Sure, happens all the time. And seriously, just in this short a time, I already know I like you. You're amazing. You're beautiful and obviously a good fighter. And the way you carry yourself.
He shook his head, awe on his face.
I've never seen anything like it.
I wished he wasn't so cute and nice. Having creepy guys profess their adoration was a lot easier to deal with than one you liked. I remembered Sydney saying I was a hot commodity here. Scorching was more like it, apparently.
Joshua, I really like you, but...
I added hastily, seeing hope fill his features.
I'm too young to get married.
He frowned.
Didn't you say you were 18?
Okay. Age was probably not a good argument around here. I'd seen how young people had kids back in Dimitri's hometown. In a place like this, they probably had child marriages. I tried another angle.
I don't even know if I want to get married. This didn't faze him. He nodded in understanding.
We could live together first, see how we get along.
His serious expression turned back into a smile.
But I'm pretty easygoing. I'd let you win every argument.
I couldn't help it. I laughed. Well, then, I'm going to have to win this one and tell you I'm just not ready for any of it. Besides, I'm already involved with someone.
Dimitri?
No, another guy. He's back at the tainted court. I couldn't even believe I was saying that. Joshua frowned.
Why isn't he here protecting you, then?
Because that's not how he is, and I can take care of myself. I'd never liked the assumption that I needed rescuing. And look, even if he wasn't in the picture, I'm leaving soon anyway. It would never work out between you and me.
I understand.
Joshua looked disappointed, but seemed to be taking the rejection okay.
Maybe when you've got everything sorted out, you'll come back.
I started to tell him not to wait for me, and that he should just marry someone else, despite how ridiculous it was at his age. But then I realized that was a pointless comment. In Joshua's fantasies, he could probably marry someone else now, and then add me onto his harem later, like Sarah and Paulette. So I just simply said, maybe. Groping for a change in subject, I searched for anything to distract us. My eyes fell on the chair and a leafy pattern carved into it. That's really neat.
Thanks,
he said, walking over. To my relief, he didn't pursue the earlier topic. He ran his hand lovingly over the ornately carved wood. The design looked like braided leaves.
I did it myself.
Really? I asked in true surprise. That's amazing.
If you like it.
His hand moved, and I feared there was a kiss or embrace coming. Instead, he reached into his shirt pocket and produced a finely carved wooden bracelet. It was a simple, sinuous design, the true marvel being how narrow and delicate it was to all be one piece. The wood had been polished to brilliance.
Here.
He handed me the bracelet. This is for me? I ran my finger along the smooth edge.
If you want it, I made it while you're out today, so you'll remember me after you leave.
I hesitated, wondering if accepting this would be encouraging him. No, I decided. I'd made my views on teenage marriage clear, and anyway, he looked so nervous I couldn't stand the thought of hurting his feelings. I slipped it onto my wrist. Of course I'll remember. Thank you. From the happy look on his face, taking the bracelet made up for my earlier refusal. He showed me a few more details around the cave and then followed my suggestion to join the others at the fire. We could hear the music echoing through the trees long before we made it back, and while it was hardly my style, there was something warm and friendly about this community's way of life. I'd never been to summer camp, but I imagined this was what it'd be like. Sydney and Dimitri sat near the group's edge. They were quiet and watchful, but everyone else sang, clapped, and talked. Again, I was stunned at how easily Dompierre's humans and Maroi could all be involved with one another. Mixed couples were everywhere. And one, a human and Maroi, were openly making out. Every so often when he kissed her neck, he'd also bite and take some blood. I had to glance away. I turned back toward my friends. Sydney noticed me and looked relieved. Dimitri's expression was unreadable. Like always, the others' eyes followed my movement, and to my surprise, I saw open jealousy on some of the guys' faces. I hoped they didn't think Joshua and I had been off getting naked in the cave. That was hardly the reputation I wanted to leave behind. I have to talk to Sydney, I told him over the noise. I decided it'd be best to keep my distance before any rumors started, and truthfully, Sydney looked like she wanted me by her side. Joshua nodded, and I turned away. I'd taken two steps when a fist suddenly came right toward my face. I'd had no defenses up and just barely had the presence of mind to turn my head and catch the blow on my cheek, rather than end up with a broken nose. After the initial surprise, all my training kicked in. I quickly sidestepped out of the line of attack and put my body into a fighter stance. The music and singing stopped and I turned to face my attacker. Angeline. She stood in a way similar to my own, fists clenched and eyes completely honed in on me.
Okay, she said. It's time to find out how tough you really are.
What it was time for was someone, say like a parent, to come and drag her off and punish her for punching guests. Amazingly, no one moved or tried to stop her. No, that wasn't quite true. One person stood up. Dimitri had sprung to action the instant he saw me in danger. I expected him to come pull Angeline away, but a group of keepers hastily moved to his side, saying something to him that I couldn't hear. They didn't try to physically restrain him, but whatever they said, it kept him where he stood. I would have demanded to know what they'd told him, but Angeline was coming at me again. It looked like I was on my own. Angeline was short, even for a Dampier, but her whole body was packed with strength. She was pretty fast, too, though not fast enough to get that second hit in on me. I neatly dodged it and kept my distance, not wanting to go on the offensive at this girl. She could probably do a fair amount of damage in a fight, but there was a sloppy, no, more like rough, edge to it. She was a scrapper, someone who'd done a lot of brawling but without any formal training.
Are you insane?
I exclaimed, moving out of the way of another assault.
Stop this. I don't want to hurt you.
Sure, she said. That's what you want everyone to think, right? If you don't actually have to fight, then they'll all go on believing those marks are real.
They are real.
The insinuation that I'd faked my tattoos sparked my temper, but I refused to get drawn into this ridiculous scuffle.
Prove it, she said, coming at me again. Prove you're who you say you are.
It was like a dance, keeping away from her. I could have done it all night, and a few dismayed cries from the crowd demanded we get on with it.
I don't have to prove anything, I told her.
It's a lie, then. Her breathing was heavy now. She was working a lot harder than me.
Everything you tainted do is a lie.
Not true, I said. Why was Dimitri letting this go on? Out of the corner of my eye, I caught sight of him, and so help me, he was smiling. Meanwhile, Angeline was still continuing her tirade as she tried to hit me.
You all lie. You're all weak, especially your royals. They're the worst of all.
You don't know them at all. You don't know anything about them. She might be able to carry on a conversation, but I could see her growing increasingly frustrated. If not for the fact I was pretty sure she'd hit me in the back, I would have taken the noble approach and simply walked away.
I know enough, she said. I know they're selfish and spoiled and don't do anything for themselves. They don't care about anyone else. They're all the same.
I actually agreed with Angeline about some royals, but didn't like the generalization.
Don't talk about things you don't understand, I snapped. They're not all like that.
They are, she said, pleased to see me angry.
I wish they were all dead.
It was hardly enough to push me into offense mode, but the comment did cloud my thoughts enough that I let her get through my guard, just a little. I never would have let that happen with a Strigoi, but I'd underestimated this wild girl. Her legs snaked out just enough to hit my knee, and it was like tossing a spark into gasoline. Everything exploded. With that hit, I stumbled slightly, and she pushed her advantage. My battle instincts took over, and I had no choice but to strike back before she could hit me. People began cheering now that the fight was really going. I was on offense, trying to subdue her, meaning the physical contact had jumped up exponentially. I was still better than her, no doubt, but in trying to get to her, I put myself in her range. She landed a few blows on me, nothing serious, before I was able to tackle her to the ground. I expected that to be the end, but she pushed back against me before I could fully restrain her. We rolled over, and she tried to take the dominant position. I couldn't allow that, and managed a punch on the side of her face that was a lot harder than the earlier one.
I thought that would be the end of the fight. My hit had knocked her off me, and I started to stand. But then that little bitch grabbed my hair and jerked me back down. I twisted out of her hold, though I'm pretty sure she took some hair away with her. And this time managed to fully pin her, throwing all my weight and strength into it as I pressed down. I knew it had to be painful, but didn't really care. She'd started it. Besides, this skirmish had gone beyond defense. Pulling someone's hair was just plain dirty. Angelina made a few more attempts to break away, but when it became clear she couldn't, those around us began whistling and cheering. A few moments later, that dark and furious look vanished from Angeline's face, replaced by resignation. I eyed her warily, not about to let down my guard. "Fine," she said. "I guess it's okay. Go ahead."
"Huh? What's okay?" I demanded.
"It's okay if you marry my brother."
Chapter 13.
"It's not funny." "You're right," agreed Sydney. "It's not funny. It's hilarious."
We were back at Raymond's house in the privacy of our room. It had taken forever for us to get away from the fireside festivities, particularly after learning a terrible fact about a keeper custom. Well, I thought it was terrible, at least. It turned out that if someone wanted to marry someone else around here, the prospective bride and groom each had to battle it out with the other's nearest relative of the same sex. Angeline had spotted Joshua's interest from the moment I'd arrived, and when she'd seen the bracelet, she'd assumed that some sort of arrangement had been made. It therefore fell on her, as his sister, to make sure I was worthy. She still didn't like or entirely trust me, but proving myself a capable fighter had shot me up in her esteem, allowing her to consent to our engagement. It had then taken a lot of fast talking to convince everyone, including Joshua, that there was no engagement. Had there been, I'd learned, Dimitri would have had to stand in as my relative and fight Joshua.
"Stop that," I chastised.
Dimitri leaned against one of the room's walls, arms crossed, watching as I rubbed where Angeline had hit my cheekbone. It was hardly the worst injury I'd ever had, but I'd definitely have a bruise tomorrow. There was a small smile on his face.
"I told you not to encourage him,"
came Dimitri's calm response. "Whatever, you didn't see this coming. You just didn't want me to..." I bit off my words. I wouldn't say what was on my mind, but Dimitri was jealous. Or possessive. Or whatever. I just knew he'd been irritated to see me friendly with Joshua, and very amused at my outrage over Angeline's attack. I abruptly turned to Sydney, who was just as entertained as Dimitri. In fact, I was pretty sure I'd never seen her smile so much.
"Did you know about this custom?"
"No," she admitted. "But I'm not surprised. I told you they're savage. A lot of ordinary problems are settled by fights like that."
"It's stupid," I said, not caring that I was whining.
I touched the top of my head, wishing I had a mirror to see if Angeline had taken a noticeable chunk of hair. Although, she wasn't bad. Unpolished, but not bad. Are they all that tough? The humans and Maroi, too?
"That's my understanding."
I pondered that. I was annoyed and embarrassed by what had happened, but I had to admit the keepers were suddenly way more interesting. How ironic that such a backward group had the insight to teach everyone to fight, no matter their race. Meanwhile, my own enlightened culture still refused to teach defense. "And that's why Strigoi don't bother them," I murmured, recalling breakfast. I didn't even realize what I'd said until Dimitri's smile dropped. He glanced toward the window, face grim.
"I should check in with Boris again and see what he's found."
He turned back toward Sydney.
"It won't take long. We don't all need to go. Should I just take your car since I only have to go a little ways?"
She shrugged and reached for her keys. We learned earlier that Sydney's phone could pick up a signal about 10 minutes from the village. He was right. There really was no reason for us all to go for a quick phone call. After my fight, Sydney and I were reasonably safe. No one would mess with me now. Still, I didn't like the thought of Dimitri reliving his Strigoi days alone. "You should still go," I told her, thinking fast. "I need to check in on Lyssa." Not entirely a lie. What my friends had heard from Joe was still weighing on me. "I can usually still keep track of what's going on around me at the same time, but it might be better if you're away, especially in case alchemists do show up." My logic was faulty, though her colleagues were still a concern. "I doubt they'd come while it's dark," she said, "but I don't really want to hang out if you're just going to stare into space." She didn't admit it, and I didn't need to say anything, but I suspected she didn't want someone else driving her car anyway. Dimitri thought her coming was unnecessary and said as much, but apparently he didn't feel like he could boss her around as much as me. So they both set out, leaving me alone in the room. I watched them wistfully. Despite how annoying his earlier mockery had been, I was worried about him. I'd seen the effect of the last call and wished I could be there now to comfort him. I had a feeling he wouldn't have allowed that. So I accepted Sydney's accompaniment as a small victory. With them gone, I decided I really would check in with Lyssa. I'd said it more as an excuse, but truthfully, it beat the alternative. Going back out and socializing. I didn't want any more people congratulating me, and apparently Joshua had read my maybe and acceptance of the bracelet as a real commitment. I still thought he was devastatingly cute, but couldn't handle seeing his adoration. Sitting cross-legged on Angeline's bed, I opened myself to the bond and what Lyssa was experiencing. She was walking through the halls of a building I didn't recognize at first. A moment later, I got my bearings. It was a building at court that housed a large spa and salon, as well as the hideout of Rhonda the Gypsy. It seemed weird that Lyssa would be going to get her fortune told, but once I got a glimpse of her companions, I knew she was up to something else. The usual suspects were with her, Adrian and Christian. My heart leapt at seeing Adrian again, especially after the Joshua incident. My last spirit dream had been too brief. Christian was holding Lyssa's hand as they walked, his grip warm and reassuring. He looked confident and determined, though with that typically snarky half-smile of his. Lyssa was the one who felt nervous and was clearly bracing herself for something. I could feel her dreading her next task, even though she believed it was necessary. "Is this it?" she asked, coming to a halt in front of a door.
"I think so," said Christian. "That receptionist said it was the red one."
Lyssa hesitated only a moment and then knocked. Nothing. Either the room was empty or she was being ignored. She held up her hand again and the door opened. Ambrose stood there, stunning as always, even in jeans and a casual blue t-shirt. The clothing hugged his body in a way that showed off every muscle. He could have walked straight off the cover of GQ.
"Hey,"
he said, clearly surprised. "Hey," said Lyssa back. "We were wondering if we could talk to you." Ambrose, ever so slightly, inclined his head toward the room.
"I'm kind of busy right now."
Beyond him, Lyssa could see a massage table with a Moroi woman lying face down. The lower half of her body had a towel over it, but her back was bare, shining in the dim lighting with oil. Scented candles burned in the room, and a calming kind of New Age music played softly.
"Wow," said Adrian. "You don't waste any time, do you? She's only been in a grave a few hours, and you've already got someone new."
Tatiana had finally been laid to rest earlier in the day, just before sunset. The burial had had much less fanfare than the original attempt. Ambrose gave Adrian a sharp look.
"She's my client. It's my job. You forget that some of us have to work for a living."
"Please?" asked Lyssa, hastily stepping in front of Adrian. "It won't take long."
Ambrose looked my friends over a moment and then sighed. He glanced behind him.
Lorraine, I have to step outside. I'll be right back, okay?
Okay, called the woman. She shifted, facing him. She was older than I'd expected, mid-40s or so. I guess if you were paying for a massage, there was no reason not to have a masseuse half your age.
Hurry back.
He gave her a dazzling smile as he shut the door, a smile that dropped once he was alone with my friends.
Okay, what's going on? I don't like the looks on your faces.
Ambrose might have radically deviated from a Dampier man's normal life, but he'd had the same training as any guardian. He was observant. He was always on the lookout for potential threats.
We, wanted to talk to you about...
Lissa hesitated. Talking about investigations and interrogations was one thing. Carrying them out was another.
About Tatiana's murder.
Ambrose's eyebrows rose.
Ah, I see. Not sure what there is to say, except that I don't think Rose did it. I don't think you believe that either, despite what's going around. Everyone's talking about how shocked and upset you are. You're getting a lot of sympathy over having been tricked by such a dangerous and sinister friend.
Lissa felt her cheeks flush. By publicly condemning me and renouncing our friendship, Lissa was keeping herself out of trouble. It had been Abe and Tasha's advice, and Lissa knew it was sound. Yet, even though it was an act, she still felt guilty. Christian stepped to her defense.
Back off. That's not what this is about.
What is it about, then?
Asked Ambrose. Lissa jumped in, worried Christian and Adrian might upset Ambrose and make it difficult to get answers.
Abe Mazur told us that in the courtroom you said, or, did something to Rose.
Ambrose looked shocked, and I had to give him points for being convincing.
Did something? What does that mean? Does Mazur think I, like, hit on her in front of all those people?
I don't know, admitted Lissa. He just saw something, that's all.
I wished her good luck,
said Ambrose, still looking offended.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Lissa had made a point to talk to Ambrose before Abe could, fearing Abe's methods would involve threats and a lot of physical force. Now she was wondering if she was doing so great a job.
Look, we're just trying to find out who really killed the queen. You were close to her. If there's anything, anything at all you've got that can help us, we'd appreciate it. We need it.
Ambrose glanced curiously between them. Then he suddenly understood.
You think I did it? That's what this is about.
None of them said anything.
I can't believe this. I already got this from the Guardians, but from you? I thought you knew me better. We don't know you at all, said Adrian flatly. All we know is you had lots of access to my aunt.
He pointed at the door.
And obviously, it didn't take you long to move on. Did you miss the part where I said that's my job? I'm giving her a massage, that's it. Not everything is sordid and dirty.
Ambrose shook his head in frustration and ran a hand through his brown hair.
My relationship with Tatiana wasn't dirty either. I cared about her. I would never do anything to hurt her. Don't statistics say most murders happen between close people?
Asked Christian. Lissa glared at him and Adrian.
Stop it, both of you!
She looked back at Ambrose.
No one's accusing you of anything. But you were around her a lot, and Rose told me you were upset about the age law.
When I first heard about it, yeah,
Ambrose said.
And even then, I told Rose there was some mistake, that there must be something we didn't know. Tatiana would have never put those Dampiers in danger without a good reason. Like making herself look good in front of all those terrified royals?
Asked Christian.
Watch it,
warned Adrian. Lissa couldn't decide which was more annoying, her two guys teaming up to spar against Ambrose, or them throwing barbs at each other.
No!
Ambrose's voice rang through the narrow hall.
She didn't want to do that. But if she didn't, worse things were going to happen. There are people who wanted, still want, to round up all the Dompiers who don't fight and force them into it. Tatiana passed the age law as a way to stall that.
Silence fell. I'd already learned this from Tatiana's note, but it was shocking news to my friends. Ambrose kept going, seeing he was gaining ground.
She was actually open to lots of other options. She wanted to explore spirit. She approved of Maroi learning to fight.
That got a reaction from Adrian. He still wore that sardonic expression, but I could also see faint lines of pain and sorrow on his face. The burial earlier must have been hard on him, and hearing others reveal information you hadn't known about a loved one had to hurt.
"Well, I obviously wasn't sleeping with her like you were," said Adrian.
"But I knew her pretty well, too. She never said a word about anything like that."
"Not publicly,"
agreed Ambrose.
"Not even privately. Only a few people knew. She was having a small group of Maroi trained in secret. Men and women, different ages. She wanted to see how well Maroi could learn. If it was possible for them to defend themselves. But she knew people'd be upset about it, so she made the group and their trainer keep quiet."
Adrian gave no response to this, and I could see his thoughts had turned inward. Ambrose's revelation wasn't bad news exactly, but Adrian was still hurt at the thought that his aunt had kept so much from him. Lyssa, meanwhile, was eating the news up, seizing and analyzing every piece of info.
"Who were they? The Maroi being trained?"
"I don't know," said Ambrose. "Tatiana was quiet about it. I never found out their names, just their instructor."
"Who was?"
prompted Christian.
"Grant."
Christian and Lyssa exchanged startled looks.
"My Grant?"
she asked.
"The one Tatiana assigned to me?"
Ambrose nodded.
"That's why she gave him to you. She trusted him."
Lyssa said nothing, but I heard her thoughts loud and clear. She'd been pleased and surprised when Grant and Serena, the guardians who had replaced Dimitri and me, had offered to teach Lyssa and Christian basic defense moves. Lyssa had thought she'd simply stumbled into a progressive-thinking guardian, not realizing she had one of the pioneers in teaching combat to Maroi. Some piece of this was important. She and I were both certain, though neither of us could make the connection. Lyssa puzzled it over, not protesting when Adrian and Christian threw in some questions of their own. Ambrose was still clearly offended by the Inquisition, but he answered everything with forced patience. He had alibis, and his affection and regard for Tatiana never wavered. Lyssa believed him, though Christian and Adrian still seemed skeptical.
"Everyone's been all over me about her death," said Ambrose. "But nobody questioned Blake very long."
"Blake?" asked Lyssa.
"Blake Lazar. Someone else she was...
involved with?"
suggested Christian, rolling his eyes.
"Him?"
exclaimed Adrian in disgust.
"No way. She wouldn't stoop that low."
Lyssa racked her brain through the Lazar family, but couldn't peg the name. There were just too many of them.
"Who is he?"
"An idiot," said Adrian. "Makes me look like an upstanding member of society."
That actually brought a smile to Ambrose's face.
"I agree, but he's a pretty idiot, and Tatiana liked that."
I heard affection in his voice as he spoke her name.
"She was sleeping with him too?" Lyssa asked.
Adrian winced at the mention of his great-aunt's sex life, but a whole new world of possibilities had opened up. More lovers meant more suspects.
"How did you feel about that?"
Ambrose's amusement faded. He gave her a sharp look.
"Not jealous enough to kill her, if that's what you're getting at. We had an understanding. She and I were close. Yes, involved, but we both saw other people too."
"Wait,"
said Christian. I had the feeling he was really enjoying this now. Tatiana's murder was no joke, but a soap opera was definitely unfolding before them.
"You were sleeping with other people too? This is getting hard to follow."
Not for Lyssa. In fact, it was becoming clearer and clearer that Tatiana's murder could have been a crime of passion, rather than anything political. Like Abe had said, someone with access to her bedroom was a likely suspect. And some woman jealous over sharing a lover with Tatiana? That was perhaps the most convincing motive thus far. If only we knew the women.
Who? Lyssa asked. Who else were you seeing?
No one who'd kill her, said Ambrose sternly. I'm not giving you names. I'm entitled to some privacy. So are they.
Not if one of them was jealous and killed my aunt, growled Adrian.
Joshua had looked down on Adrian for not protecting me, but in that moment, defending his aunt's honor, he looked as fierce as any guardian or keeper warrior. It was kind of sexy.
None of them killed her, I'm certain, said Ambrose. And as much as I despise him, I don't think Blake did either. He's not smart enough to pull it off and frame Rose.
Ambrose gestured to the door. His teeth were clenched and lines of frustration marred his handsome face.
Look, I don't know what else I can say to convince you. I need to get back in there. I'm sorry if I seem difficult, but this has been kind of hard on me, okay? Believe me, I'd love it if you could find out who did that to her.
Pain flashed through his eyes. He swallowed and looked down for a moment, as though he didn't want them to know just how much he'd cared about Tatiana. When he looked up again, his expression was fierce and determined again.
I want you to, and will help if I can, but I'm telling you, look for someone with political motives, not romantic ones.
Lyssa still had a million more questions. Ambrose might be convinced the murder was free of jealousy and sex, but she wasn't. She would have really liked the names of his other women, but didn't want to push too hard. Yet. For a moment, she considered compelling him as she had Joe. But no, she wouldn't cross that line again, especially with someone she considered a friend. At least not yet.
Okay, she said reluctantly. Thank you. Thank you for helping us.
Ambrose seemed surprised at her politeness, and his face softened.
I'll see if I can dig up anything to help you. They're keeping her rooms and possessions locked down, but I might still be able to get in there. I'll let you know.
Lyssa smiled, genuinely grateful.
Thank you. That'd be great.
A touch on my arm brought me back to the drab little room in West Virginia. Sydney and Dimitri were looking down at me.
Rose,
asked Dimitri. I had a feeling this wasn't the first time he'd tried to get my attention.
Hey, I said.
I blinked a couple of times, settling myself back into this reality.
You're back. You called the Strigoi?
He didn't visibly react to the word, but I knew he hated hearing it.
Yes, I got a hold of Boris's contact.
Sydney wrapped her arms around herself.
Crazy conversation. Some of it was in English. It was even scarier than before.
I shivered involuntarily, glad that I missed it. But did you find out anything?
Boris gave me the name of a Strigoi who knows Sonya, and probably knows where she is,
Dimitri said.
It's actually someone I've met, but phone calls only go so far with Strigoi. There's no way to contact him, except to go in person. Boris only had his address.
Where is it? I asked.
Lexington, Kentucky.
Oh, for God's sake, I moaned. Why not the Bahamas or the Corn Palace?
Dimitri tried to hide a smile. It might have been at my expense, but if I'd lightened his mood, I was grateful.
If we leave right now, we can reach him before morning.
I glanced around. Tough choice. Leave all this for electricity and plumbing? Now Sydney grinned.
And no more marriage proposals.
And we'll probably have to fight Strigoi,
added Dimitri. I jumped to my feet. How soon can we go?
Chapter 14.
The keepers had mixed reactions to us leaving. They were usually glad to see outsiders go, especially since we had Sydney with us. But after the fight, they held me up as some kind of superhero and were enchanted by the idea of me marrying into their family. Seeing me in action meant some of the women were beginning to eye Dimitri now, too. I wasn't in the mood to watch them flirt with him, especially since, according to their courtship rules, I would apparently have to be the one to battle it out with any prospective fiancé. Naturally, we didn't tell the Keepers our exact plans, but we did mention we'd likely be encountering Strigoi, which caused quite a reaction. Most of that reaction was excitement and awe, which continued to boost our reputations as fierce warriors. Angeline's response, however, was totally unexpected.
"Take me with you," she said, grabbing a hold of my arm, just as I started down the forest path toward the car.
"Sorry," I said, still a little weirded out after her earlier hostility.
"We have to do this alone."
"I can help. You beat me, but you saw what I can do. I'm good. I could take a Strigoi."
For all her fierceness, I knew Angeline didn't have a clue about what she'd be facing if she ever met an actual Strigoi. The few Keepers who bore Molniya marks spoke little about the encounters, faces grave. They understood. Angeline didn't. She also didn't realize that any novice at St. Vladimir's in the secondary school could probably take her out. She had raw potential, true, but it needed a lot of work.
"You might be able to," I said, not wanting to hurt her feelings.
"But it's just not possible for you to come with us." I would have lied and given her a vague "maybe sometime," but since that had led Joshua to thinking we were semi-engaged, I decided I'd better not. I expected more boasts about her battle prowess. We'd learned she was regarded as one of the best young fighters in the compound, and with her pretty looks, she had plenty of admirers, too. A lot of it had gone to her head, and she liked to talk about how she could beat anyone or anything up. Again, I was reminded of Jill. Jill also had a lot to learn about the true meaning of battle, but was still eager to jump in. She was quieter and more cautious than Angeline, though, so Angeline's next direction caught me off guard.
"Please, it's not just the Strigoi. I want to see the world. I need to see something else outside of this place."
Her voice was pitched low, out of the range of the others.
"I've only been to Rubiesville twice, and they say that's nothing compared to other cities."
"It's not," I agreed. I didn't even consider it a city.
"Please," she begged again, this time her voice trembling. "Take me with you."
Suddenly, I felt sad for her. Her brother had also shown a little longing for the outside world, but nothing like this. He'd joked that electricity would be nice, but I knew he was happy enough without the perks of the modern world. But for Angeline, the situation was much more desperate. I too knew what it was like to feel trapped in one's life and was legitimately sorry for what I had to say.
"I can't, Angeline. We have to go on our own. I'm sorry. I really am."
Her blue eyes shimmered, and she raced off into the woods before I could see her cry. I felt horrible after that and couldn't stop thinking about her as we made our farewells. I was so distracted, I even let Joshua hug me goodbye. Getting back on the road was a relief. I was glad to be away from the Keepers and was ready to spring into action and start helping Lyssa. Lexington was our first step. We had a 6-hour drive ahead of us, and Sydney, per usual, seemed adamant that no one else was going to drive her car. Dimitri and I made futile protests, finally giving up when we realized that if we were going to be facing Strigoi soon, it was probably best we rest and conserve our strength. The address for Donovan, the Strigoi who allegedly knew Sonia, was only where he could be found at night. That meant we had to make it to Lexington before sunrise, so we wouldn't lose him when he went to his daytime lair. It also meant we'd be meeting Strigoi in the dark. Certain that little would happen on the drive, especially once we were out of West Virginia, Dimitri and I agreed we could doze a little, seeing as neither of us had had a full night's sleep. Even though the lulling of the car was soothing, I drifted in and out of restless sleep. After a few hours of this, I simply settled into the trance-like state that brought me to Lyssa. It was a good thing, too. I'd stumbled into one of the biggest events facing the Moroi. The nomination process to elect the new king or queen was about to begin. It was the first of many steps, and everyone was excited, given how rare monarch elections truly were. This was an event none of my friends had expected to see anytime soon in our lives, and considering recent events, well, we all had a special interest. The future of the Moroi was at stake here. Lyssa was sitting on the edge of a chair in one of the royal ballrooms, a huge, sweeping space with vaulted ceilings and gold detailing everywhere. I'd been in this dazzling room before, with its murals and elaborate molding. Chandeliers glittered above. It had held the graduate luncheon, where newly made guardians put on their best faces and hoped to attract a good assignment. Now the room was arranged like the council chamber, with a long table on one side of the room that was set with 12 chairs. Opposite that table were rows and rows of other chairs, where the audience sat when the council was in session. Except, now there were about 4 times as many chairs as usual, which probably explained the need for this room. Every single chair was filled. In fact, people were even standing, crowding in as best they could. Agitated-looking guardians moved among the herd, keeping them out of doorways and making sure the bystanders were arranged in a way that allowed for optimal security. Christian sat on one side of Lyssa, and Adrian sat beside Christian. To my pleasant surprise, Eddie and Mia sat nearby, too. Mia was a Moroi friend of ours who had gone to St. Vladimir's and was nearly as hardcore as Tasha about Moroi needing to defend themselves. My beloved father was nowhere in sight. None of them spoke. Conversation would have been difficult among the buzzing and humming of so many people. And besides, my friends were too awestruck by what was about to happen. There was so much to see and experience, and none of them had realized just how big the crowd would be. Abe had said things would move fast once Tatiana was buried, and they certainly had.
"Do you know who I am?"
A loud voice caught Lyssa's attention, just barely carrying above the din. Lyssa glanced down the row, a few seats away from Adrian. 2 Moroi, a man and a woman, sat side by side and were looking up at a very angry woman. Her hands were on her hips, and the pink velvet dress she wore seemed outlandish next to the couple's jeans and t-shirts. It also wasn't going to hold up so well once she stepped outside of air conditioning. A glare twisted her face.
"I am Marcella Batica."
When that didn't get a reaction from the couple, she added,
"Prince Batica is my brother, and our late queen was my 3rd cousin twice removed. There are no seats left, and someone like me cannot stand against the wall with the rest of that mob."
The couple exchanged glances.
"I guess you should have gotten here earlier, Lady Batica," said the man.
Marcella gaped in outrage.
"Didn't you just hear who I am? Don't you know who your betters are? I insist you give up your seats."
The couple still seemed unfazed.
"This session is open to everyone, and there weren't assigned seats last time I checked," said the woman. "We're entitled to ours as much as you are."
Marcella turned to the guardian beside her in outrage. He shrugged. His job was to protect her from threats. He wasn't going to oust others from their chairs, particularly when they weren't breaking any rules. Marcella gave a haughty, "Huh," before turning sharply and stalking away, no doubt to harass some other poor soul.
"This," said Adrian, "is going to be delightful."
Lyssa smiled and turned back to studying the rest of the room. As she did, I became aware of something startling. I couldn't tell exactly who was who, but the crowd wasn't composed entirely of royals, as most council sessions were. There were tons of commoners, just like the couple sitting near my friends. Most Moroi didn't bother with court. They were out in the world, living their lives and trying to survive while the royals pranced around at court and made laws. But not today. A new leader was going to be chosen, and that was of interest to all Moroi. The milling and chaos continued for a while until one of the guardians finally declared the room to be at capacity. Those outside were outraged, but their cries were quickly silenced when the guardians closed the doors, sealing off the ballroom. Shortly thereafter, the 11 council members took their seats and, to my shock, Adrian's father, Nathan Ivashkov, took the 12th chair. The court's herald yelled and called everyone to attention. He was someone who'd been chosen because of his remarkable voice, though I always wondered why they didn't just use a microphone in these situations. More old-world traditions, I supposed. That and excellent acoustics. Nathan spoke once the room settled down.
In the absence of our beloved queen.
He paused, looking down mournfully to offer a moment of respect before continuing. In anyone else, I might have suspected his feelings were faked, particularly after seeing him grovel so much in front of Tatiana. But no, Nathan had loved his prickly aunt as much as Adrian had.
And in the wake of this terrible tragedy, I will be moderating the upcoming trials and elections.
What did I tell you?
Muttered Adrian. He had no fuzzy affection for his father.
Delightful.
Nathan droned on a bit about the importance of what was to come and some other points about Moroi tradition. It was obvious, though, that like me, everyone in the room really wanted to get down to the main event. The nominations. He seemed to realize that, too, and sped up the formalities. Finally, he got to the good stuff.
Each family, if they choose, may have one nominee for the crown who will take the tests all monarchs have endured since the beginning of time.
I thought that beginning of time part was a bold and probably unverified exaggeration, but whatever.
The only exclusion is the Ivashkovs, since back-to-back monarchs from the same family aren't allowed. For candidacy, three nominations are required from Moroi of royal blood and proper age.
He then added some stuff about what happened in the event more than one person was nominated from the same family. But even I knew the chances of that happening were non-existent. Each royal house wanted to get the best advantage here, and that would involve a unified standing behind one candidate. Satisfied everyone understood, Nathan nodded and gestured grandly to the audience.
Let the nominations begin.
For a moment, nothing happened. It kind of reminded me of when I'd been back in school, when a teacher would say something like, "Who'd like to present their first paper?" Everyone kind of waited for someone else to get things going, and at last, it happened. A man I didn't recognize stood up.
I nominate Princess Ariana Zelsky.
Ariana, as princess, sat on the council and was an expected choice. She gave a gracious nod to the man. A second man, presumably from their family, also stood and gave the second nomination. The third and final nomination came from another Zelsky. A very unexpected one. He was Ariana's brother, a world traveler who was almost never at court, and also the man my mother guarded. Janine Hathaway was most likely in this room, I realized. I wished Lyssa would look around and find her, but Lyssa was too focused on the proceedings. After everything I'd been through, I suddenly had a desperate longing to see my mother. With three nominations, Nathan declared,
Princess Ariana Zelsky is entered as a candidate.
He scrawled something on a piece of paper in front of him, his motions full of flourish.
Continue.
After that, the nominations came in rapid succession. Many were princes and princesses, but others were respected and still high-ranking members of the families. The Ozera candidate, Ronald, was not the family's council member, nor was he anyone I knew.
He's not one of Aunt Tasha's ideal candidates,
Christian murmured to Lyssa.
but she admits he's not a moron.
I didn't know much about most of the other candidates either. A couple like Ariana Zelsky, I had a good impression of. There were also a couple I'd always found appalling. The 10th candidate was Rufus Taurus, Daniela's cousin. She'd married into the Ivashkovs from the Taurus family and seemed delighted to see her cousin declared a nominee.
I don't like him,
said Adrian, making a face.
He's always telling me to do something useful with my life.
Nathan wrote down Rufus's name and then rolled up the paper like a scroll. Despite the appearance of antique customs, I suspected a secretary in the audience was typing up everything being said here on a laptop.
Well,
declared Nathan,
that concludes.
I nominate Princess Vasilisa Dragomir.
Lissa's head jerked to the left, and through her eyes I recognized a familiar figure. Tasha Ozera. She'd stood and spoken the words loudly and confidently, glancing around with those ice blue eyes as if daring anyone to disagree. The room froze. No whispers, no shifting in chairs. Just utter and complete silence. Judging from the faces, the Ozera family's nominee was the second most astonished person in the room to hear Tasha speak. The first, of course, was Alyssa herself. It took a moment for Nathan to get his mouth working.
That's not...
Beside Lissa, Christian suddenly stood up.
I second the nomination.
And before Christian had even sat down, Adrian was on his feet.
I confirm the nomination.
All eyes in the room were on Lissa and her friends, and then, as one, the crowd turned toward Nathan Ivashkov. Again, he seemed to have trouble finding his voice.
That,
he managed at last,
is not a legal nomination. Due to its current council standing, the Dragomir line is regrettably not eligible to present a candidate.
Tasha, never afraid of talking in a crowd or taking on impossible odds, leapt back up. I could tell she was eager to. She was good at making speeches and challenging the system.
Monarch nominees don't need a council position or quorum to run for the throne.
That makes no sense,
said Nathan. There were mutters of agreement.
Check the law books, Nate. I mean Lord Ivashkov.
Yes, there he was at last. My tactful father had joined the conversation. Abe had been leaning against a wall near the doorway, dressed splendidly in a black suit with a shirt and tie that were exactly the same shade of emerald green. My mother stood beside him, the slightest hint of a smile on her face. For a moment, I was captivated as I studied them side by side. My mother, the perfect picture of guardian excellence and decorum. My father, always capable of achieving his goals no matter how twisted the means. Uneasily, I began to understand how I'd inherited my bizarre personality.
Nominees have no requirements concerning how many people are in their family,
continued Abe jovially.
They only need 3 royal nominations to be confirmed.
Nathan gestured angrily toward where his own wayward son and Christian sat.
They aren't from her family. They don't need to be,
countered Abe.
They just need to be from a royal family. They are. Her candidacy is within the law, so long as the princess accepts.
All heads swiveled toward Lissa now, as though they were suddenly just noticing her. Lissa hadn't twitched since the startling events began. She was in too much shock. Her thoughts seemed to move both fast and slow. Part of her couldn't even start to process what was happening around her. The rest of her mind was spinning with questions. What was going on? Was this a joke? Or maybe a spirit-induced hallucination? Had she finally gone crazy? Was she dreaming? Was it a trick? If so, why would her own friends have been the ones to do it? Why would they do this to her? And for the love of God, would everyone stop staring at her? She could handle attention. She'd been born and raised for it. And like Tasha, Lissa could address a crowd and make bold statements. When she supported them and was prepared. Neither of those things applied to this situation. This was pretty much the last thing in the world she had expected or wanted. And so, she couldn't bring herself to react or even consider a response. She stayed where she was, silent and shell-shocked. Then, something snapped her from her trance. Christian's hand. He'd taken Lissa's, wrapping his fingers with hers. He gave her a gentle squeeze, and the warmth and energy he sent brought her back to life. Slowly, she looked around the room, meeting the eyes of those all watching her. She saw Tasha's determined gaze, my father's cunning look, and even my mother's expectation. The last one proved most startling of all. How could Janine Hathaway, who always did what was right and could barely crack a joke, be going along with this?